Well, thank you, Titus O'Reilly, so much for agreeing to be part of this Last Post podcast interview. You've done a lot of writing on sport, and you're a great writer. It's a humorous read, your latest book, Cheat, the not-so-subtle art of conning your way to sporting glory. In your book, Titus, you speak of the conditions needed for cheating. What are those conditions?
Well, they're pretty simple. You really just need something to compete over and people. They're the two ingredients. If you've got both of those, you're going to have cheating.
Well, it's a lot of interest in that because of our interest in sport too, I suppose. Why are people still shocked when they find out about people cheating?
Well, this is the thing that kept cropping up for me, is the constant surprise of both fans and the public and sport administrators that cheating occurs when... You can track it back to the ancient Olympics, you know. It's the most consistent thing in sport, is people trying to cheat. But I think there's just this part of human nature that we want to believe the best in athletes we see striving for great things. And we want to believe what we're seeing is, you know, is fair dinkum, is you know, an actual great feat rather than it's occasionally rigged. And so we keep forgetting. We're like the goldfish going around the bowl.
So is it suspended disbelief?
I think there's an element of that, and I think we also, we treasure the memories of people doing great things. I mean, it's a bit like with Lance Armstrong. People stayed up all night for 7 years you know, to watch him win, and it's kind of sad to think, you know, that when that was coming out, that you could have wasted all that time.
They felt they'd invested in Lance.
Well, they have. I mean, this is the thing we do in our sporting teams and all this. We invest time and effort and emotion into these things. And so it's quite a shock when you find out that some of them are, you know, many are, but some aren't the heroes we thought they were.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. What football team, what Australian rules football team do you follow? Is it Melbourne?
Yes, I'm a long-suffering Melbourne supporter, so we probably need more cheating, actually.
I was about to say that could be. But then again, I'm a long-suffering Collingwood supporter, so we probably need that too. in your book, Cheat, which once again is a funny read, your friend who played Trivial Pursuit, was he actually cheating?
Well, yeah, so we used to know this couple, and we'd go around to their house, and they'd insist that afterwards, after dinner, we'd play Trivial Pursuit. And the husband, it became pretty obvious, had memorised all the cards. So it'd be a question like, who was Ross Perot's running mate in the 1992 president election? And he'd sort of do this thing of going, oh, I don't know why I think this. It's just a guess, and I'm sure I'm wrong, but is it Vice Admiral James Bond Stockdale? And someone would say, yes, that's who it was. And she'd say, oh, I can't believe I got that right. I must have read it somewhere. And we all sat there thinking, yeah, you read it on the card.
Isn't that incredible? That's incredible. Actually, that brings a personal experience too, Titus. My twin brother liked to win at Trivial Pursuit, and one night on the way to bed, I walked past his bedroom and foolishly had the door open, and he was there reading the cards.
Well, I think there's a human element to cheating, which is people want to appear either... They want to appear good at something. They kind of want the esteem of other people. And I think the worst of cheating is often when that just goes too far, where people are just desperate to impress others, which is where they get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that's right, Titus. Actually, I think my brother was worried that he was facing his nemesis in Trivial Pursuit the following night, and I can't remember if he won or not, but yeah. Now, I guess there's so many wonderful and funny examples of cheating in your book. You give some stories that are funny, and they're pathetic, and they're just a whole lot of incredible things tossed together. You write about the Chicago basketballer Donald DJ Cooper Jr. What happened with Donald?
Well, DJ Cooper was a very decent college basketballer in the States, and ended up just missing out on the NBA but going to Europe and playing for Monaco, which is a very good standard. And he did his normal drug test, and urine sample was provided, and he got called in, and they said, "Oh, we've got some good news. You've tested negative for performance-enhancing drugs, but you have tested positive for being pregnant." And it turned out that he was taking something, so he swapped his urine for his girlfriend's to try and beat the test. His girlfriend, unfortunately, didn't know she was pregnant, and that's how they found out.
And what happened? He actually left Monaco, and he said it was for family reasons.
Yeah, it is. When he actually left after being suspended, he didn't mention the suspension in his public statement. He said it was for family reasons, which was technically true, I guess, in hindsight.
Jeez, that's funny. And I guess also then we read on in your book Cheat about Bonn. Bonn's the headquarters for the Paralympics, of course. In November 2000, a package arrived. And why was this package so important? I mean, this is a classic. You say if you cheat at anything, it's important not to win by too much. And yes, but what happened with the Spanish basketball side? That was incredible.
Well, this package contained a gold medal from the 2000 Sydney Paralympics, and the uniform and some of the money that they got paid each day to be at the Olympics for food and things like that, all returned. And it turned out that what had happened was the Spanish Paralympic team had sent, in the category of mentally impaired basketball, they had sent a team of men who all were not mentally impaired but very good at basketball, who pretended to be mentally impaired, to win the gold medal, which they went on to do. And the only problem was one of the guys they'd hired to play in all these games, including the gold medal game, was an undercover investigative journalist who was the one that mailed the gold medal and uniform back to the Paralympic headquarters in Bonn and wrote the tell-all story showing that basically the entire thing had been an enormous fraud.
Isn't it incredible? And wasn't it funny because their photographs got splashed apparently over in the Spanish papers, and one girl rang up or reported. She said, "Look, I used to go out with that guy. He's emotionally retarded, but he's definitely not mentally retarded."
Yeah, there was all these comments that came out on some of the things when all their pictures were put up celebrating this gold medal, and a lot of people sort of went, "Hang on, I know that guy. That's not true." But it just got me thinking, it was sort of the genesis for the book, that story, because it got me thinking, is there anything people won't try cheating? You know, like you kind of know with something like the Tour de France, you end up famous and rich and, you know, Lance Armstrong got to date Sheryl Crow.
Yep,
so there were a lot of reasons why you might actually go into something like that. Where, you know, the Paralympics, there's not a lot of money or fame. And you kind of think, well, people just cheat at anything. Is there nothing we won't cheat at? And unfortunately, through my research, I found out that, no, there's not much we won't cheat at.
Isn't that incredible? Even Monopoly, goddammit, it's incredible. And with the basketball team, I think also these guys who weren't mentally retarded were winning by a lot at halftime, and their coach told them to play it down a bit. They were overdoing it. They were just they were playing too well.
Yeah, one of their first games, they were winning by about 30 points at half time, and the coach had to talk one out and say, rein it in a bit. And, you know, it was sort of a lot of these guys who did it. The journalist that wrote the tell-all story, he was asked, why do you think some of these guys agreed to cheat? And a lot of it came down to they saw it as a free holiday to Sydney. So that's why they did it. So it didn't take a lot to get them over the line, unfortunately.
Incredible. Did you see any photos of that team, Titus? I can imagine the face. How did they look mentally retarded? Did they pose as though they were? It would have been incredible.
It was more... So the intellectually impaired category in the Paralympics is the people who... basically, it's people with an IQ of 70 or below. So.
That's right.
That can be a wide range of, you know, various reasons people can have that. And basically, they got sort of coached a little bit of how to...
appear.
More their behaviour than anything else.
Yep.
you know, a lot of not talking and things like that around other people. And there's a few incidences where people saw right through it and thought it was obviously not true. One of the Australian coaches at the Games said it was pretty obvious because the players were doing things on the basketball court, not just physically, but also without the ball when they were moving around and defending and doing things like that. It was obvious they were at a level well above what, you know, the average intellectually disabled player or athlete is able to do.
Yes.
And it had a kind of a sad postscript because the Paralympics decided at the end it was just easier to ban, and they did for about 12 years, intellectually disabled people from the Games rather than come up with ways to actually enforce whether they actually were or not. So the real losers in that whole incident
were
the intellectually disabled athletes, who most of them were fair income, highly competitive people that wanted to perform at the top level, and because of this they weren't allowed to.
Wow, that's something to carry around your neck for the rest of your life, isn't it? Robbing
you
of that. The 1904 Olympic Marathon in St. Louis was another classic example, Titus. I mean, the standard of competitors was not particularly high, as you mentioned. And, I mean, as an IE or as an EG, American gymnast George Esser, was it? Won three gold medals and he had a wooden leg.
Yeah, the St. Louis Olympics in 1904 were the first Olympics outside of Europe of the modern Olympics. They were the third Olympic Games. And it had been decided for a variety of reasons to host it in St. Louis, which is an inner city in the United States. And back in 1904, that was important because we didn't have planes. So you had to get a long boat trip and then you'd have to get the train for days to get there. So basically the world didn't show up. It was basically the Americans and then whatever people were already in the US at the time who decided to do it. So you had a terrible standard. On top of that, for the marathon, and it was only the third time marathons had been run at the Olympics.
Well, tell us about the marathon. Yeah, that was a classic too.
Well, they decided to run it in, it was 32 degree heat. So instead of running it in the morning, they ran it in the afternoon.
Makes sense.
In the heat of the day. They also decided to only offer the athletes water at 2 points because they wanted to test what dehydration did to people.
Oh. So, thank you.
Yeah, and so you had these sort of a lot of people who were competing in the had never run a marathon before, suddenly going at 72 degree heat. The city of St. Louis had not been closed for the marathon, so they had to compete with traffic and all these sort of things. And from the minute it started, you had people just dropping like flies. You know, there was in the heat and the dust. You had several almost deaths from people swallowing too much dust as they ran behind vehicles on these dusty hot roads. You had one runner who was from South Africa get attacked by a wild dog and chased a mile off course.
Jeez.
And then one guy, an American by the name of Fred Laws, he retired at the 9 mile mark from dehydration, got in a car who drove him to the 19 mile mark where the car broke down. So he got out of the car, found that he was feeling much better and ran all the way to the stadium and almost claimed the gold medal until someone pointed out just as they were putting the winner's wreath around his neck he'd actually gotten the train.
geez, that's like Percy Jones catching the tram.
Exactly. So you then had the winner of the actual race was a guy called Thomas Hicks, who was an American and who he was in real trouble early on in the race from dehydration, and his doctor that was travelling with him in a car behind him gave him strychnine, egg whites and brandy in a mixture, which was the first ever case of doping in the Olympics. It was actually illegal back then, not illegal. And strychnine, which, you know, you'd know as a poison that is used in Agatha Christie novels more than anything else, in very tiny doses it can give you a bit of a boost instead of acting as a poison. But they gave him a little bit too much because he had to be carried into the stadium and passed out as he crossed the finish line, and took four doctors an hour to revive him.
Holy hell, and the winner is?
And that was the winner, so they couldn't even do do the ceremony. So,
oh, classic. They should make a movie out of that. That's incredible. And in your book, Cheat, you also take a look at soccer, and we all know there's a great history of diving and playing for Friesen soccer. But the thing that surprised me, it even happens in lawn bowls. You talk about New Zealand lawn bowls player Gary Lawson in the Asia-Pacific Championship in Kuala Lumpur 2009. Gary was known as the bad boy of New Zealand bowls. What happened there?
He's known as the bad boy of New Zealand bowls, which I don't know, I assume that means something like you have a low Uber rating or something. I'm not sure how you managed to be the bad boy. Maybe an overdue library book or something. But he was known, I think, for just speaking his mind a bit, which got him in a bit of trouble. But they threw a game because they worked out if they, in the round robin stage before the finals, if they lost their next game, they didn't have to play the Australians in the semis, instead would go through the final against an easier opponent. So they decided to throw that game. And this happens quite a bit in sport, where basically organisations or tournaments set up a series of events that actually make it better for teams to actually lose than to win. They get a better draw or something like that if they actually lose in the knockout stage. And so that's happened in everything from badminton to darts to, you know, lawn bowls, basically. It's almost like it's too good not to cheat.
That's right. And actually, you can almost understand Gary Bad Boy Lawson getting involved. But then he got involved in a fight in a taxi or something.
Yeah, there was not long after that happened, he got in a fight with a taxi driver, and there was accusations of all sorts of things, which he managed to get off. But, you know, he sort of is known as the bad boy of lawn bowls, which is the oddest title I think I've ever heard in sport.
Jeez, that's sounds terrifying.
That's right.
Yes. There's so much in this book, Titus. It's a real pleasure to read, and it's been a real pleasure to hear your recital. Before we go, Titus, is there one more story of cheating that boggles your mind so much that you have trouble believing it? Can you give us one of your favourites?
Well, one of the ones that's just purely odd, I think, is in the baseball in America, there was... the Minnesota Twins used to play in a dome, and one of the guys who ran the dome and was sort of looked after the dome, he would turn the air con on and point it in a certain direction when the Twins were batting in the hope of increasing home run.
Right.
Just purely through cheating through air conditioning. I just found absolutely amazing that someone would go to that much trouble. You know, you hear of doping and all these other things, but cheating by air conditioning was a new one for me.
That's a classic. That deserves an award. And wasn't that similar to what the Russians did, surprisingly or not surprisingly, the 1980 Olympics, was it, when they opened the gate to let in the javelin throwing or something?
Yeah, the javelin throwing at the massive stadium, and had these giant doors that were used for sort of bringing big things into the stadium and taking them out, which were normally shut during events, but they kept opening them whenever the Russians got up to throw, and this breeze would enter behind them, and then they would then shut the doors when anyone else got up. And it worked. The guy that won was the Russian gold medalist. But that happens occasionally. I mean, in baseball, there was a guy who used to move. He had the outfield fences on wheels, and he would wheel them out when the opposition were batting and wheel them in when his team came to bat, which was just quite blatant. But he found a loophole in the rules, and there was actually no rule that stopped you doing that at the time. So they had to bring in one to stop him.
Jeez. And just a thought that came to mind. You mentioned Australian rules, and obviously the cheating not being such a concern in Australian rules. Maybe that's cause to do with the scoring system, because a goal is just 6 points, and in soccer a goal is very important. So, yeah, maybe we'd see more dives if they changed the scoring system.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at all sports and you look why would do people cheat in some and not others, it usually actually comes down to logic, not a moral failing. So... If you are in soccer, you know, 2 to 3 goals is sort of the average in each match. And if you get a penalty kick, you've got a 75% chance of kicking that usually. And, you know, so one goal in a match where you sort of have three goals is a huge advantage, where in rugby league and AFL, it's just not as big an advantage. You'd look at something like the Tour de France. The Tour de France, they can actually measure how much energy you output because you're basically pedalling into a machine, so they can measure the energy you output. And if you improve by 1% in the Tour de France, the amount of energy you output across the whole race, it's a difference between being 15th and 1st.
Wow.
So there are these things in various sports where certain types of cheating are almost, you know, the temptation.
There's an encouragement there, yeah.
Yeah, because it works. Where if you said the, you know, if you said the Adelaide Crows this year were 1% better, it's probably not going to move them even bottom from bottom of the ladder. You know, you're not going to suddenly be the best team in the league by being 1% better. There's too many variables.
You can't imagine their coach holding a press conference and saying, "We're confident of improving by 1%.
That's right. So, you know, it's these sports that are very tight and very close tend to get a lot more cheating because one small act can have a much bigger impact, where other sports require a lot more wholesale cheating to get any outcome. There tends to be salary cap cheating and things like that in these team sports because that's a better way to sort of cheat than a lot of the other ways.
Yeah, that's true too. It's been an absolute pleasure. And on behalf of readers and listeners, Titus, thank you very much for your time.
Anytime. Thanks very much.
Titus, that was wonderful.
No problem.
Thank you so much for that.